She can't be here today. So I will be giving her part of the presentation that deals with translating the science into, thank you, into federal nutrition policy. So I'm not Rachel, I'm still Eve. I still have no relationships to disclose regarding personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation during the past month, 12 months. Okay, so what I want to do with this portion of the presentation is to just discuss some of the major conclusions that were reached by the 2010 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. As we discussed, the committee was divided into seven subcommittees: energy balance and weight management, nutrient adequacy, fatty acids and cholesterol, carbohydrates and protein. I'll just note that this is the first time that protein has been given its own section of the report. Sodium, potassium, and water, alcohol, and then food safety and technology. And, you know, when involved in this process, you just can't help but think, man, this is huge. I mean, this is a lot of topics. Nutrition is big. So this covers a broad range of topics. Each of these topics had its own chapter in the DGAC report. And towards the end of this presentation, I do want to note that they also had developed two additional chapters. One was on the total diet, and then one was on translating and integrating the evidence. And they really considered this to be their call to action. So what can, you know, the public do to help meet these recommendations? So obviously I can't cover all the content in the 600 pages or, you know, cover all the questions, but we did want to highlight some of those things that were received, I think, the most public interest and some of the major differences that were seen in this process. Okay, energy balance and weight management. As I already mentioned, the committee really felt like overweight and obesity, and I mean it is, overweight and obesity is, you know, a huge public health crisis. So they really viewed the dietary guidelines through the lens of an overweight and obese population. So they really wanted to focus on what are things that we can do that will impact body weight, nutrition, body weight, body weight, body weight. We had a lot of questions that dealt with body weight as the outcome. And that was really where the Energy Balance and Weight Management Subcommittee had a lot of content. The subcommittee addressed questions in three main areas. Those were food environment and dietary behaviors. It's the first time food environment was discussed. Body weight over the life cycle, and then physical activity. So those were the three main content areas. And then a few of the subtopics that they considered are highlighted on this slide. And so through all the subcommittees, I'll just highlight a few of the things that they found. So regarding the food environment, they asked, what effects do the food environment and dietary behaviors have on body weight? And regarding the environment, they concluded that moderately strong evidence indicates that the food environment is associated with dietary intake, especially less consumption of fruits and vegetables and higher body weight. So for example, one of the things that they particularly looked at was supermarkets and proximity to supermarkets. And they found that the presence of supermarkets and other sources of fruits and vegetables in local neighborhoods are associated with lower body mass index, while lack of supermarkets and long distances to supermarkets are associated with higher body weight. So the point being is they were looking at more than just, you know, the dietary guidance. What else is impacting what people are eating? The committee recommended that in order to reduce the obesity epidemic, actions must be taken to improve the food environment. And this needs to be done at, you know, the policy level, local, state, and national, as well as the private sector. The committee did consider a variety of behaviors, one of which I already mentioned, self-monitoring. These were three others that had large bodies of evidence. Fast food, the consumption of fast food. They looked at eating out, but there wasn't a lot of evidence on any other type of eating out other than fast food intake. So eating at a general restaurant, there's just not a lot out there on that particular part of it, as well as portion size and screen time, which isn't a dietary behavior, but they covered it here. For all of these topics, they found strong evidence. So they found a strong relationship between the consumption of fast food intake and increased body weight in children and adults. They noted that this particularly becomes an issue with the consumption of one or more fast food meals per week. In terms of portion size, there's a direct relationship: increased portion size, increased body weight. And screen time, the same thing, that in adults and children, screen time is directly associated with increased overweight and obesity, with the strongest association being with television viewing. Okay, the committee asked a series of questions on childhood adiposity. The one that Rachel highlighted in the slide was sugar-sweetened beverages. They found that there was strong evidence that supports that greater intake of sugar-sweetened beverages is associated with increased adiposity in children. And as such, they recommended that consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages in childhood should be discouraged because, one, of the positive association with increased adiposity, and two, because of the need to replace empty calories that are in foods such as sugar-sweetened beverages with nutrient-rich energy for optimal growth and development. And then the last one that we have here is macronutrient proportion, and this is just the distribution of carbohydrate, protein, and fat that should be consumed. The committee asked, what is the relationship between macronutrient proportion and body weight? And they found that there was strong and consistent evidence that when calorie intake is controlled, macronutrient proportion of the diet is not related to losing weight. The important factor there is calories. So they recommended that individuals wanting to lose weight or maintain weight loss should consume reduced calorie diets within the ranges recommended in the DRIs, the acceptable macronutrient distribution ranges. Further, low carbohydrate and high protein diets are not more effective than other calorie controlled diets for weight loss and weight maintenance. So they had, this was a kind of a, or it was a topic of great popular or public interest. Okay, the nutrient adequacy section of the report considered questions related to dietary components overconsumed and underconsumed, nutrients of concern, vitamins and mineral supplements, and then they did talk about some behaviors in the relationship with nutrient intake. I think a really valuable part of this section of the report is that it does give a snapshot of current dietary intake of Americans. So, although, you know, there are kind of pieces of the dietary intake throughout the report, this is really the place where you can go and see how people or how Americans are meeting or in many cases not meeting the current recommendations. So it had the latest NHANES data that allowed us to describe current intake. The committee did spend time talking about the paradox that some Americans are overweight, but they are not adequately nourished. And they began this section, the nutrient adequacy chapter, by asking what dietary components are overconsumed. And this was actually intentional. Traditionally, the nutrient adequacy section has dealt with nutrient deficiencies. And, you know, what are we not consuming enough of? And for the first time, they wanted to start off by this is what we're consuming in excess and dealing with those things in excess. So their first question was, what nutrients and dietary components are overconsumed by the general public? These included, for both children and adults, total energy intake, especially calories from solid fats and added sugars, sodium, percent of energy from saturated fats, intake of refined grains, and then for men and for boys 12 to 19, total cholesterol intake is high. They also asked what food groups and selected dietary components are underconsumed by the general public. And for both adults and children, these were vegetables, fruits, whole grains, fluid milk and milk products, as compared to cheese, and then oils. The committee discussed a lot that, you know, they didn't want to just come out by saying increase intake of this, that they really put a lot of emphasis on replacing. So replacing refined grains with whole grains. Replacing solid fats with oils. So that was a theme in the report. They also asked what nutrients are underconsumed by the general public, and not just which ones are underconsumed, but which also pose a public health threat. So that's how they define their nutrients of concern. And the four that were identified for the general public are vitamin D, calcium, potassium, and dietary fiber. Another topic that received quite a bit of attention was their discussion of a multivitamin and multimineral supplement. The committee felt that for the general healthy population, there is no evidence to support a recommendation for the use of a daily multivitamin, multimineral supplement in the primary prevention of chronic disease. And they do have a section for special subgroups of the population where supplements are recommended, but just a multivitamin mineral, they didn't feel that as though it should be recommended for the general public. Okay. Okay, fatty acids and cholesterol. This section covered saturated fats, trans fats, unsaturated fats, cholesterol, as well as food sources of certain fats, such as seafood. They also covered nuts and chocolate, so they had a variety of different questions in this topic. As with previous guidance, the 2010 DGAC concluded that there is a relationship between the intake of saturated fats, a positive relationship, between the intake of saturated fats and total cholesterol, LDL, cardiovascular disease risk, insulin resistance, and type 2 diabetes. So that's really not different than what has been found previously. In agreement with other guidance, they did recommend that saturated fat intake should be less than 10% of calories. However, they took it a step further and said that ideally the goal should be moved down to less than 7% of calories. So that is a little bit of a difference in their recommendation. Another area that has received a lot of attention was the committee's review of seafood. The fatty acids and cholesterol subcommittee dealt with the benefits of seafood intake, and then we had another subcommittee, food safety, that dealt with the risk relationship, and they worked together. So this subcommittee dealt with the benefits, and they concluded that moderate evidence shows that consumption of 2 servings of seafood per week at 4 ounces a serving, so 8 ounces a week, is associated with reduced cardiac mortality for coronary heart disease or sudden death in persons with and without cardiovascular disease. This is different than previous guidance. Previous guidance has really focused on those individuals with cardiovascular disease, and now the evidence has grown in those individuals in the, you know, without cardiovascular disease, so a recommendation more for the general public. Moderate evidence also indicates that increased intake of long-chain omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, especially DHA, I know this is a lot, from at least 2 servings of seafood per week during pregnancy and lactation, so the same amount, is associated with increased DHA levels in breast milk and improved infant health outcomes, such as visual acuity and cognitive development. And the next slides, I'll talk about the food safety piece of it, but ultimately they felt like the benefits of consumption of seafood, even during pregnancy and lactation, outweighed the risks of methylmercury and POPs. So that was they did do a benefit-risk ratio. So overall, the committee recommended an increase in seafood intake to 2 servings per week at 4 ounces per serving. The quantity and frequency of seafood consumption is important, but they also emphasized that the type was important too, and particularly emphasizing those fish high in omega-3s, which are often, you know, lovely described as oily fish. Like, who doesn't want that? Okay, the carbohydrate and protein section was huge. They, as I mentioned, this is the first time that there was a focus on protein, and we're not highlighting any of those particular recommendations here, but they did talk about animal protein, plant protein, milk and milk products, beans and peas, vegetarian eating patterns. They also looked at dietary fiber, and the topics that you see here, whole grains, vegetables and fruits, and glycemic index and load. The committee examined the relationship between whole grain intake and a variety of different health outcomes, and overall they found that there is evidence that whole grain intake, it seems to be particularly those high fiber whole grains, does protect against cardiovascular disease and is also associated with lower body weight. So as I mentioned, the committee focused a lot on a replacement concept, so not just going and running out and telling everyone to eat more grains, but rather reduce intake of refined grains and increasing intake of whole grains. As with previous advisory committees, the 2010 DGAC discussed vegetables and fruits. There's really no difference. They didn't come out and say don't eat them, and they still recommended them, but they did do some research in terms of, does there seem to be a threshold level? And there does seem to be a threshold that the health benefits seem to occur with at least 5 servings per day. And there does seem to be a linear improvement in health outcomes above that level. So they were kind of looking at that, kind of that threshold piece for that topic. One of the other things that came out in the vegetable and fruit discussion was the need to consider dietary patterns. That then fueled the total diet chapter, which I'll talk about in a minute, but that maybe we shouldn't be focusing on these individual food groups, but how it all works together. So that the important thing is a total diet and not just talking about vegetables and fruits or one particular topic. Okay, glycemic index and load is one that has received quite a bit of attention. I do want to note that they were looking at glycemic index and load in terms, again, of a healthy population. So does a healthy individual going shopping need to consider glycemic index and load? So not dealing in terms of medical nutrition therapy. And they concluded overall that when selecting carbohydrate foods, there is no need for concern with glycemic index or glycemic load for the general population. Okay, so as the section name implies, the sodium, potassium, and water section address sodium, potassium, and water. As is pretty well established, the committee concluded that a strong body of evidence has documented that in adults, as sodium intake decreases, so does blood pressure. What was unique in this report is that they also discussed this relationship in children. So they found, although it was a moderate body of evidence for children, they also saw that as sodium intake goes down in children, blood pressure goes down. So the 2010 DGAC noted the adverse effects of sodium on blood pressure appear to begin early in life. So it's not just kind of an adult issue. In 2005, the DGAC recommended a daily sodium intake of less than 2,300 milligrams per day for the general population. However, they also said for certain groups of the population, including middle-aged adults and older adults, that recommendation should be 1,500 milligrams per day. Well, in 2010, we now see that older adults, middle-aged adults, and kind of these other groups of the population really are the majority of adults. So 70% of the adults should be eating 1,500 milligrams of sodium. Overall, the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee said that for the general population, the ultimate, ideally, we will gradually move down to 1,500 milligrams per day. So that was a change. Keeping it at 2,300 with the goal of gradually reducing to 1,500. For potassium, they found that there is moderate evidence that higher intake of potassium is associated with lower BP. That's pretty well accepted. For water, they really relied on a previous IOM report, basically indicating that water intake isn't of great concern in the U.S., that we seem to be doing pretty well managing water intake. It doesn't need to be a primary emphasis. Okay, for alcohol, the committee felt like there was, I mean, the evidence is there regarding alcohol and a variety of different outcomes. They did look at alcohol and weight gain, coronary heart disease, as well as unintentional injury. Overall, in terms of body weight, again, body weight being a major theme, they found that moderate evidence suggests that moderate drinking is not associated with weight gain. They define moderate drinking as an average of 1 to 2 alcoholic beverages per day. And they did note that heavier consumption over time is associated with weight gain, which I think makes sense. They noted that regardless of the alcoholic beverage, in general, all alcoholic beverages contain calories and they're not a good source of nutrients. But the results from most studies say that when alcohol is consumed in moderation, it's just not a factor in terms of body weight. As has been found previously, they did note the relationship between moderate alcohol consumption and reduced risk of cardiovascular disease. And in terms of unintentional injury, they continue to support other recommendations that, you know, drinking excessively is associated with unintentional injury, and that the relationship is not as clear in those who drink a moderate amount of alcohol. Okay, so food safety and technology is the final subcommittee. The basic four food safety principles that have been identified to reduce the risk of foodborne illnesses remain unchanged. These principles are clean, separate, cook, and chill. That's been there. They didn't invent that, and they just continue it. Clean, cook, chill, and separate. However, they did have questions within each of these kind of categories. Regarding cleaning, one of the questions that they asked was what techniques for hand sanitation are associated with favorable food safety outcomes? And this is one of the things that I think it's so interesting that the dietary guidelines are broad, or so broad. You know, we have hand washing and, you know, sodium intake. It's quite a broad range of topics. They found that strong evidence shows that hand washing with plain soap for 20 to 30 seconds followed by proper hand drying is effective technique for preventing cross-contamination during food preparation. And they also considered the popular hand sanitizers and concluded that strong evidence shows that alcohol-based, rinse-free hand sanitizers are an adequate alternative when proper hand washing and plain soap is not possible. Regarding cooking and chilling, they did look at, you know, are people using thermometers when cooking meat and poultry, and do people have refrigerator and freezer temperature gauges? And in general, no. So this was an area of education that they thought needs to be improved, encouraging people to use meat thermometers, using thermometers in cooking seafood. This is a big area of education that needs to be enhanced, as well as refrigerator and freezer thermometers. As already mentioned, they did look at the risks associated with seafood consumption. And as I mentioned, they felt that the benefits of consuming 8 ounces of seafood a week outweigh the risks from methylmercury and POPs. And they felt this was the case even for women who are pregnant or breastfeeding. Overall, they felt that you could go up to 12 ounces of seafood a week with minimal risk. But that the big piece there is that to consume a variety of seafood. So if you consume a variety and not eating the same thing all the time, you minimize your risk. They did also advise consuming limited intake of large predatory fish, which has been out there. And one of the things that they did note was that, and if you worked in this area, you know, is that this is a very confusing communication point, talking about risk-benefit of seafood intake with general consumers. A lot of people are very scared about the seafood concept and the risks associated with it. So they talked a lot about the need for a lot of good communication techniques on discussing seafood risk and benefit ratios and promoting seafood consumption. Okay, as I've mentioned before, in terms of the context of the recommendations, they, again, really focused on overweight and obesity. Also, for the first time, the dietary guidelines are for the general healthy population. And there was a big push in 2010 that, you know, what is healthy anymore? You have a lot of people who are healthy, but they may have a risk factor or may have a chronic disease. I mean, how are we defining the healthy population? The majority of the population may not fall there. And so they really emphasized the need for expanding that general healthy population group, and some of their questions did deal with the larger definition of healthy. I do want to spend just a minute talking about the total diet and translating the evidence chapters. If you never, you know, look at anything else in the Dietary Guidelines report, I would say read these two pieces. The total diet and the translating the evidence chapters really are where they pulled it all together. So they kind of had these all these different groups going on, and the total diet piece is where they really started talking about let's put the total diet into context. There also is an executive summary that is a kind of a snapshot of everything. So what is a total diet? The committee defined total diet as the combination of foods and beverages that provide energy and nutrients and constitute an individual's complete dietary intake on average over time. So they recognize that it really is more than just the pieces. It's that the pieces all do work together. And they noted the importance of recognizing that there are cultural differences, differences in tastes, differences in preferences. And they looked at the evidence related to a variety of dietary patterns, including the DASH pattern, Mediterranean dietary patterns, vegetarian dietary patterns, that you can have a healthy diet with a variety of patterns. It's not rigid. It's not one size fits all, that there really is a broad range of these. Now, they noted that in our current environment, you have to make special emphasis, so you have to make choices appropriately to eat that healthy diet, but that it can be done in a number of ways. Okay, then for the translating the evidence, as I said, this was where they kind of took all the pieces and they put them, felt like they came out with four main themes for the report. The first was reduce the incidence and prevalence of overweight and obesity. No surprise. By reducing overall calorie intake and increasing physical activity. The second was to shift food intake patterns to a more plant-based diet that emphasizes vegetables, fruits, beans and peas, whole grains, nuts and seeds. In addition, increase the intake of seafood, fat-free and low-fat milk and milk products, and consume only moderate amounts of lean meats, poultry, and eggs. There was a lot of public confusion, I would think, over how they use the term plant-based diets. They didn't necessarily mean it in the terms of a vegetarian diet, which is how it was often portrayed, but they just meant that most foods should be from a plant source. They also, the third point in this section was that Americans need to significantly reduce intakes of foods containing added sugars and solid fats because these dietary components contribute excess calories and few, if any, nutrients. In addition, reduce sodium intake, lower intake of refined grains, especially refined grains that are coupled with added sugars and solid fats. And their fourth point was to increase physical activity and meet the physical activity guidelines. So reduce overweight and obesity, increase the intake of certain things, reduce the intake of others, and be physically active. Further, the DGAC encouraged all stakeholders to take actions to make every choice available to Americans a healthy choice. Okay, so as we said, the DGAC report was delivered to the secretaries of HHS and USDA in June. We are now working to, or excuse me, I should also say, public and agency comments on the report have been received by the writing group who are working on the policy document. So there is consideration of public comments on what the policy document, or excuse me, the report contains. Federal agencies also provide comments to the writing team. So there are topics that are covered by other areas that have an impact on other areas. And the policy writing group does receive those comments and consider those comments as well. The writing and editing phase of the dietary guidelines has occurred. And the policy document is currently in the federal clearance process. And the release of the seventh edition of the dietary guidelines is coming soon. Is that all we can say? So with that, I'll turn it over to Kay, and she's going to talk about communicating some of the main themes.